Lawrence had no desire to speak with Yong Xing, still less to be trifled with, and his mood was not much improved by the physical unpleasantness of making his halting way to the prince's quarters, all the way to the stern of the ship. When the attendants tried to make him wait in the antechamber, he said shortly, "He may send word when he is ready," and turned at once to go. There was a hasty and huddled conference, one man going so far as to stand in the doorway to bar the way out, and after a moment Lawrence was ushered directly into the great cabin. The two gaping holes in the walls, opposite one another, had been stuffed with wads of blue silk to keep out the wind. But still the long banners of inscribed parchment hanging upon the walls blew and rattled now and again in the draught. Yong Xing sat straight-backed upon an armchair draped in red cloth, at a small writing-table of lacquered wood. Despite the motion of the ship, his brush moved steadily from inkpot to paper, never dripping, the shining wet characters formed up in neat lines and rows.
"You wished to see me, sir?" Lawrence said.
Yong Xing completed a final line and set aside his brush without immediately answering. He took a stone seal, resting in a small pool of red ink, and pressed it at the bottom of the page, then folded up the page and laid it to one side, atop another similar sheet, and folded these both into a piece of waxed cloth.
"Fong Li," he called.
Lawrence started. He had not even noticed the attendant standing in the corner, nondescript in plain robes of dark blue cotton, who now came forward. Feng was a tall fellow, but so permanently stooped that all Lawrence could see of him was the perfect line running across his head, ahead of which his dark hair was shaven to the skin. He gave Lawrence one quick, darting glance, mutely curious, then lifted the whole table up and carried it away to the side of the room, not spilling a drop of the ink. He hurried back quickly with a footrest for Yong Xing, then drew back into the corner of the room. Plainly Yong Xing did not mean to send him away for the interview. The prince sat up erect, with his arms resting upon the chair, and did not offer Lawrence a seat, though two more chairs stood against the far wall. This set the tone straight away. Lawrence felt his shoulders stiffening even before Yong Xing had begun.
"Though you have only been brought along for necessity's sake," Yong Xing said coldly, "you imagine that you remain companion to Lung Tian Xiang, and may continue to treat him as your property. And now the worst has been realized. Through your vicious and reckless behavior, he has come to grave injury."
Lawrence pressed his lips together. He did not trust himself to make anything resembling a civilized remark in response. He had questioned his own judgment both before taking Temeraire into the battle and all through the long following night, remembering the sound of the dreadful impact and Temeraire's labored and painful breath. But to have Yong Xing question it was another matter.
"Is that all?" he said.
Yong Xing had perhaps expected him to grovel, or beg forgiveness. Certainly this short answer made the prince more voluble with anger.
"Are you so lacking in all right principles?" he said. "You have no remorse. You would have taken Lung Tian Xiang to his death as easily as ridden a horse to foundering. You are not to go aloft with him again, and you will keep these low servants of yours away. I will set my own guards around him."
"Sir," Lawrence said bluntly, "you may go to the devil."
Yong Xing broke off, looking more taken aback than offended at finding himself interrupted, and Lawrence added,
"And as for your guards, if any one of them sets foot upon my dragon deck, I will have Temeraire pitch him overboard. Good day."
He made a short bow and did not stay to hear a response, if Yong Xing even made one, but turned and went directly from the room. The attendants stared as he went past them and did not this time attempt to block his way. He was forcing his leg to obey his wishes, moving swiftly. He paid for the bravado. By the time he reached his own cabin at the very other end of the ship's interminable length, his leg had begun to twitch and shudder with every step as if palsied. He was glad to reach the safety of his chair, and to soothe his ruffled temper with a private glass of wine. Perhaps he had spoken intemperately, but he did not regret it in the least. Yong Xing should at least know that not all British officers and gentlemen were prepared to bow and scrape to his every tyrannous whim. As satisfying a resolution as this was, however, Lawrence could not help but acknowledge to himself that his defiance was a good deal strengthened by the conviction that Yong Xing would never willingly bend on the central, the essential point of his separation from Temeraire. The ministry, in Hammond's person, might have something to gain in exchange for all their crawling. For his own part, Lawrence had nothing of great importance left to lose. This was a lowering thought, and he put down his glass and sat in silent gloom a while instead, rubbing his aching leg propped upon a locker. Six bells rang on deck, and faintly he heard the pipe shrilling away, the scrape and clatter of the hands going to their breakfast on the berth deck below, and the smell of strong tea came drifting over from the galley. Having finished his glass and eased his leg a little, Lawrence at last got himself back onto his feet, and he crossed to Riley's cabin and tapped on the door. He meant to ask Riley to station several of the marines to keep the threatened guards off the deck, and he was startled and not at all pleased to find Hammond already there, sitting before Riley's writing-desk with a shadow of conscious guilt and anxiety upon his face. "Lawrence," Riley said, after offering him a chair, "I have been speaking with Mr. Hammond about the passengers," and Lawrence noticed that Riley himself was looking tired and anxious. "He has brought to my attention that they have all been keeping below decks since this news about the Indiamen came out. It cannot go on like this for 7 months. We must let them come on deck and take the air somehow. I am sure you will not object. I think we must let them walk about the Dragon deck. We do not dare put them near the hands." No suggestion could have possibly been more unwelcome, nor come at a worse moment. Lawrence eyed Hammond in mingled irritation and something very near despair. The man already seemed to be possessed of an evil genius for disaster, at least from Lawrence's view, and the prospect of a long journey spent suffering one after another of his diplomatic machinations was increasingly grim. "I am sorry for the inconvenience," Riley said, when Lawrence did not immediately reply. "Only I do not see what else is to be done. There surely is no shortage of room." This, too, was indisputable. With so few aviators aboard and the ship's complement so nearly full, it was unfair to ask the sailors to give up any portion of their space, and could only aggravate the tensions already high. As a practical matter, Riley was perfectly correct, and it was his right as the ship's captain to decide where the passengers might be at liberty, but Yong Xing's threat had made the matter a question of principle. Lawrence would have liked to unburden himself plainly to Riley, and if Hammond had not been there, he would have done so. As it was, "Perhaps," Hammond put in hurriedly, "Captain Lawrence is concerned that they might irritate the Dragon. May I suggest that we set aside one portion for them, and that plainly demarcated? A cord, perhaps, might be strung, or else paint would do."
"That would do nicely, if you would be so kind as to explain the boundaries to them, Mr. Hammond," Riley said.
Lawrence could make no open protest without explanation, and he did not choose to be laying out his actions in front of Hammond, inviting him to comment upon them, not when there was likely nothing to gain. Riley would sympathize, or at least Lawrence hoped he would, though abruptly he was less certain. But sympathy or no, the difficulty would remain, and Lawrence did not know what else could be done. He was not resigned in the least, but he did not mean to complain and make Riley's situation more difficult.
"You will also make plain, Mr. Hammond," Lawrence said, "that they are none of them to bring small arms onto the deck, neither muskets nor swords, and in any action they are to go below decks at once. I will brook no interference with my crew or with Temeraire."
"But, sir, there are soldiers among them," Hammond protested. "I am sure they would wish to drill from time to time."
"They may wait until they reach China," Lawrence said.
Hammond followed him out of the cabin and caught him at the door to his own quarters. Inside, two ground crewmen had just brought in more chairs, and Roland and Dyer were busily laying plates out upon the cloth. The other Dragon's captains were joining Lawrence for breakfast before they took their leave.
"Sir," Hammond said, "pray allow me a moment. I must beg your pardon for having sent you to Prince Yong Xing in such a way, knowing him to be in an intemperate mood, and I assure you I blame only myself for the consequences and your quarrel. Still, I must beg you to be forbearing."
Lawrence listened to this much, frowning, and now with mounting incredulity said,
"Are you saying that you were already aware that you made this proposal to Captain Riley, knowing I had forbidden them the deck?"
His voice was rising as he spoke, and Hammond darted his eyes desperately towards the open door of the cabin. Roland and Dyer were staring wide-eyed and interested at them both, not attending to the great silver platters they were holding.
"You must understand we cannot put them in such a position. Prince Yongxing has issued a command. If we defy it openly, we humiliate him before his own—"
"Then he had best learn not to issue commands to me, sir," Lawrence said angrily. "And you would do better to tell him so, instead of carrying them out for him in this underhanded—"
"For heaven's sake! Do you imagine I have any desire to see you barred from Temeraire? All we have to bargain with is the dragon's refusal to be separated from you," Hammond said, growing heated himself. "But that alone will not get us very far without goodwill, and if Prince Yongxing cannot enforce his commands so long as we are at sea, our positions will be wholly reversed in China. Would you have us sacrifice an alliance to your pride? To say nothing," Hammond added, with a contemptible attempt at wheedling, "of any hope of keeping Temeraire."
"I am no diplomat," Lawrence said. "But I will tell you, sir, if you imagine you are likely to get so much as a thimbleful of goodwill from this prince, no matter how you truckle to him, then you are a damned fool, and I will thank you not to imagine that I may be bought by castles in the air."
Lawrence had meant to send Harcourt and the others off in a creditable manner, but his table was left to bear the social burden alone, without any assistance from his conversation. Thankfully, he had laid in good stores, and there was some advantage in being so close to the galley. Bacon, ham, eggs, and coffee came to the table steaming hot, even as they sat down, along with a portion of a great tunny, rolled in pounded ship's biscuit and fried, the rest of which had gone to Temeraire. Also a large dish of cherry preserves, and an even larger of marmalade. He ate only a little, and seized gladly on the distraction when Warren asked him to sketch the course of the battle for them. He pushed aside his mostly untouched plate to demonstrate the manoeuvres of the ships and the fleur-de-nuit with bits of crumbled bread, the salt-cellar standing for the allegiance. The dragons were just completing their own somewhat less civilised breakfast as Lawrence and the other captains came back above to the dragon deck. Lawrence was deeply gratified to find Temeraire wide awake and alert, looking much more easy with his bandages showing clean white, and engaged in persuading Maximus to try a piece of the tunny.
"It is a particularly nice one, and fresh caught this very morning," he said.
Maximus eyed the fish with deep suspicion. Temeraire had already eaten perhaps half, but its head had not been removed, and it lay gap-mouthed and staring glassily on the deck. A good £1,500 when first taken, Lawrence guessed. Even half was still impressive. Less so, however, when Maximus finally bent his head down and took it. The whole bulk made a single bite for him, and it was amusing to see him chewing with a sceptical expression. Temeraire waited expectantly. Maximus swallowed and licked his chops and said,
"It would not be so very bad, I suppose, if there were nothing else handy. But it is too slippery."
Temeraire's ruff flattened with disappointment.
"Perhaps one must develop a taste for it. I dare say they can catch you another."
Maximus snorted.
"No, I will leave the fish to you. Is there any more mutton at all?" he asked, peering over at the herdsmaster with interest.
"How many have you et up already?" Berkeley demanded, heaving himself up the stairs towards him. "4? That is enough. If you grow any more, you'll never get yourself off the ground."
Maximus ignored this and cleaned the last haunch of sheep out of the slaughtering tub. The others had finished also, and the herdmaster's mates began pumping water over the dragon deck to sluice away the blood. Shortly there was a veritable frenzy of sharks in the waters before the ship. The William of Orange was nearly abreast of them, and Riley had gone across to discuss the supplies with her captain. Now he reappeared on her deck and was rowed back over, while her men began laying out fresh supplies of wooden spars and sailcloth.
"Lord Purbeck," Riley said, climbing back up the side, "we will send the launch to fetch over the supplies, if you please."
"Shall we bring them for you instead?" Harcourt asked, calling down from the dragon deck. "We will have to clear Maximus and Lily off the deck in any case. We can just as easily ferry supplies as fly circles."
"Thank you, sir. You would oblige me greatly," Riley said, looking up and bowing, with no evident suspicion.
Harcourt's hair was pulled back tightly, the long braid concealed beneath her flying hood, while her dress coat hid her figure well enough. Maximus and Lily went aloft, without their crews, clearing room on the deck for the others to make ready. The crews rolled out the harnesses and armour and began rigging the smaller dragons out.
while the two larger flew over to the William of Orange for the supplies. The moment of departure was drawing close, and Lawrence limped over to Temeraire's side. He was conscious suddenly of a sharp, unanticipated regret.
"I do not know that dragon,"
Temeraire said to Lawrence, looking across the water at the other transport. There was a large beast sprawled sullenly upon their dragon deck, a stripy brown and green with red streaks on his wings and neck, rather like paint. Lawrence had never seen the breed before. "He is an Indian breed from one of those tribes in Canada," Sutton said, when Lawrence pointed out the strange dragon. "I think Dakota, if I am pronouncing the name correctly. I understand he and his rider, they do not use crews over there, you know, only one man to a dragon, no matter the size, were captured raiding a settlement on the frontier. It is a great coup, a vastly different breed, and I understand they are very fierce fighters. They meant to use him at the breeding grounds in Halifax, but I believe it was agreed that once Precursoris was sent to them, they should send that fellow here in exchange, and a proper bloody-minded creature he looks."
"It seems hard to send him so very far from home and to stay," Temeraire said, rather low, looking at the other dragon. "He does not look at all happy."
"He would only be sitting in the breeding grounds at Halifax instead of here, and that does not make much difference," Masoria said, stretching her wings out for the convenience of her harness crewmen, who were climbing over her to get her rigged out. "They are all much alike, and not very interesting, except for the breeding part," she added, with somewhat alarming frankness. She was a much older dragon than Temeraire, being over 30 years of age.
"That does not sound very interesting either," Temeraire said, and glumly laid himself back down. "Do you suppose they will put me in a breeding ground in China?"
"I am sure not," Lawrence said. Privately, he was quite determined he would not leave Temeraire to any such fate, no matter what the Emperor of China or anyone else had to say about it. They would hardly be making such a fuss if that were all they wanted. Masoria snorted indulgently.
"You may not think it so terrible anyway, after you have tried it."
"Stop corrupting the morals of the young," Captain Sutton slapped her side good-humouredly, and gave the harness a final reassuring tug. "There, I think we're ready. Goodbye a second time, Lawrence," he said as they clasped hands. "I expect you have had enough excitement to stand you for the whole voyage. May the rest be less eventful." The three smaller dragons leapt one after another off the deck, Nitidus scarcely even making the allegiance dip in the water, and flew over to the William of Orange. Then Maximus and Lily came back in turns to be rigged out themselves, and for Berkeley and Harcourt to make Lawrence their farewells. At last the whole formation was transferred to the other transport, leaving Temeraire alone on the allegiance once more. Riley gave the order to make sail directly. The wind coming from east-southeast and not over strong, even the stunsails were set, a fine and blooming display of white. William of Orange fired a gun to leeward as they passed, answered in a moment by Riley's order, and a cheer came to them across the water as the two transports drew finally away from one another, slow and majestic. Maximus and Lily had gone aloft for a frolic, with the energy of young dragons lately fed. They could be seen for a long while, chasing one another through the clouds above the ship, and Temeraire kept his gaze on them until distance reduced them to the size of birds. He sighed a little then and drew his head back down, curling in upon himself.
"It will be a long time before we see them again, I suppose," he said.
Lawrence put his hand on the sleek neck, silently. This parting felt somehow more final. No great bustle and noise, no sense of new adventure unfolding, only the crew going about their work still subdued, with nothing to be seen but the long blue miles of empty ocean, an uncertain road to a more uncertain destination.
"The time will pass more quickly than you expect," he said. "Come, let us have the book again."
Part 2, Chapter 6. The weather held clear for the first brief stage of their journey, with that peculiar winter cleanliness, the water very dark, the sky cloudless, and the air gradually warming as they continued the journey southward. A brisk, busy time replacing the damaged yards and hanging the sails fresh, so that their pace daily increased as they restored the ship to her old self. They saw only a couple of small merchantmen in the distance, who gave them a wide berth, and once high overhead a courier dragon going on its rounds with dispatches. Certainly a grayling, one of the long-distance flyers, but too far away for even Temeraire to recognize if it was anyone they knew. The Chinese guards had appeared promptly at dawn, the first day after the arrangement, a broad stripe of paint having marked off a section of the larboard dragon deck. Despite the absence of any visible weapons, they did indeed stand watch, as formal as marines on parade, in shifts of three. The crew were by now well aware of the quarrel, which had taken place near enough the stern windows to be overheard on deck, and were naturally inclined to be resentful of the guards' presence, and still more so of the senior members of the Chinese party, who were one and all eyed darkly, without distinction. Lawrence, however, was beginning to discern some individual traces among them, at least those who chose to come on deck. A few of the younger men showed some real enthusiasm for the sea, standing near the larboard end of the deck to best enjoy the spray as the Allegiance ploughed onwards. One young fellow, Li Honglin, was particularly adventurous, going so far as to imitate the habits of some of the midshipmen and hang off the yards, despite his unsuitable clothes. The skirts of his half-robe looked likely to entangle with the ropes, and his short black boots had soles too thick to have much purchase on the edge of the deck, unlike the bare feet or thin slippers of the sailors. His compatriots were much alarmed each time he tried it, and urged him back onto the deck loudly and with urgent gestures. The rest took the air more sedately and stayed well back from the edges. They often brought up low stools to sit upon and spoke freely among themselves in the strange rise and fall of their language, which Lawrence could not so much as break into sentences. It seemed wholly impenetrable to him. But despite the impossibility of direct conversation, he quickly came to feel that most of the attendants had no strong hostility of their own towards the British, uniformly civil, at least in expression and gesture, and usually making polite bows as they came and went. They omitted such courtesies only on those occasions when they were in Yongxing's company. At such times they followed his practice, and neither nodded nor made any gesture at all towards the British aviators, but came and went as if there were no other people at all aboard. But the prince came on deck infrequently. His cabin, with its wide windows, was spacious enough he did not need to do so for exercise. His main purpose seemed to be to frown and to look over Temeraire, who did not benefit from these inspections, as he was almost always asleep. Still recovering from his wound, he was as yet napping nearly all the day, and lay oblivious, now and again sending a small rumble through the deck with a wide and drowsy yawn, while the life of the ship went on unheeded about him. Liu Bao did not even make brief visits such as these, but remained closeted in his apartments, permanently, as far as any of them could tell. No one had seen so much of him as the tip of his nose since his first coming aboard, though he was quartered in the cabin under the poop deck, and had only to open his front door and step outside. He did not even leave to go down below to take meals, or consult with Yongxing, and only a few servants trotted back and forth between his quarters and the galley once or twice a day. Sun Kai, by contrast, scarcely spent a moment of daylight indoors. He took the air after every meal and remained on deck for long stretches at a time. On those occasions when Yongxing came above, Sun Kai always bowed formally to the prince and then kept himself quietly to one side, set apart from the retinue of servants, and the two of them did not much converse. Sun Kai's own interest was centred upon the life of the ship and her construction, and he was particularly fascinated by the great gun exercises. These Riley was forced to curtail more than he would have liked, Hammond having argued that they could not be disturbing the prince regularly. So on most days the men only ran out the guns in dumb show, without firing, and only occasionally engaged in the thunder and crash of a live exercise. In either case, Sun Kai always appeared promptly the moment the drum began to beat, if he were not already on deck at the time, and watched the proceedings intently from start to finish, not flinching even at the enormous eruption and recoil. He was careful to place himself so that he was not in the way, even as the men came racing up to the dragon deck to man its handful of guns, and by the second or third occasion the gun crews ceased to pay him any notice. When there was no exercise in train, he studied the nearby guns at close range. Those upon the dragon deck were the short-barrelled carronades, great 42-pound smashers, less accurate than the long guns, but with far less recoil,
so they did not require much room, and Sun Kai was fascinated by the fixed mounting in particular, which allowed the heavy iron barrel to slide back and forth along its path of recoil. He did not seem to think it rude to stare, either, as the men went about their work, aviators and sailors alike, though he could not have understood a word of what they were saying, and he studied the Allegiance herself with as much interest. The arrangement of her masts and sails, and with particular attention to the design of her hull. Lawrence saw him often peering down over the edge of the dragon deck at the white line of the keel, and making sketches upon the deck in an attempt to outline her construction. Yet for all his evident curiosity, he had a quality of deep reserve which went beyond the exterior, the severity of his foreign looks. His study was somehow more intense than eager, less a scholar's passion than a matter of industry and diligence, and there was nothing inviting in his manner. Hammond, undaunted, had already made a few overtures, which were received with courtesy but no warmth, and to Lawrence it seemed almost painfully obvious that Sun Kai was not welcoming. Not the least change of emotion showed on his face at Hammond's approach or departure. No smiles, no frowns, only a controlled, polite attention. Even if conversation had been possible, Lawrence did not think he could bring himself to intrude, after Hammond's example, though Sun Kai's study of the ship would certainly have benefited from some guidance, and thus offered an ideal subject of conversation. But tact forbade it as much as the barrier of language, so for the moment Lawrence contented himself with observation. At Madeira they watered and repaired their supplies of livestock from the damage which the formation's visit had done them, but did not linger in port. "All this shifting of the sails has been to some purpose. I'm beginning to have a better notion of what suits her," Riley said to Lawrence. "Would you mind Christmas at sea? I would be just as happy to put her to the test and see if I can bring her up as far as 7 knots." They sailed out of Funchal Roads majestically, with a broad spread of sail, and Riley's jubilant air announced his hopes for greater speed had been answered even before he said, 8 knots or nearly. What do you say to that?"
"I congratulate you indeed," Lawrence said. "I would not have thought it possible myself. She is going beyond anything."
He felt a curious kind of regret at their speed, wholly unfamiliar. As a captain he had never much indulged in real cracking on, feeling it inappropriate to be reckless with the king's property, but like any seaman he liked his ship to go as well as she could. He would ordinarily have shared truly in Riley's pleasure, and never looked back at the smudge of the island receding behind them. Riley had invited Lawrence and several of the ship's officers to dine, in a celebratory mood over the ship's newfound speed. As if for punishment, a brief squall blew up from nowhere during the meal, while only the hapless young Lieutenant Beckett was standing watch. He could have sailed around the world 6 times without a pause if only ships were to be controlled directly by mathematical formulae, and yet invariably managed to give quite the wrong order in any real weather. There was a mad rush from the dinner table as soon as the Allegiance first pitched beneath them, putting her head down and protesting, and they heard Temeraire make a startled small roar. Even so, the wind nearly carried away the mizzen-to-gallant sail before Riley and Purbeck could get back on deck and put things to rights. The storm blew away as quickly as it had come, the hurrying dark clouds leaving the sky washed shell pink and blue behind them. The swell died to a comfortable height, a few feet, which the Allegiance scarcely noticed, and while there was yet enough light to read by on the dragon deck, a party of the Chinese came up on deck, several servants first manoeuvring Liu Bao out through his door, trundling him across the quarter-deck and forecastle, and then at last up to the dragon deck. The older envoy was greatly altered from his last appearance, having shed perhaps a stone in weight and gone a distinctly greenish shade under his beard and pouched cheeks, so visibly uncomfortable that Lawrence could not help but be sorry for him. The servants had brought a chair for him. He was eased into it, and his face turned into the cool, wet wind, but he did not look at all as though he were improving, and when another of the attendants tried to offer him a plate of food, he only waved it away.
"Do you suppose he is going to starve to death?"
Temeraire inquired, more in a spirit of curiosity than concern, and Lawrence answered absently,
"I hope not, though he is old to be taking to sea for the first time," even as he sat up and beckoned. "Dyer, go down to Mr. Pollitt and ask if he would be so good as to step up for a moment."
Shortly, Dyer came back, with the ship's surgeon puffing along behind him in his awkward way. Pollitt had been Lawrence's own surgeon in two commands, and did not stand on ceremony, but heaved himself into a chair and said,
"Well now, sir, is it the leg?"
"No, thank you, Mr. Pollitt. I am improving nicely, but I am concerned for the Chinese gentleman's health." Lawrence pointed out Liu Bao, and Pollitt, shaking his head, opined that if he went on losing weight at such a pace, he should scarcely reach the equator. "I do not suppose they know any remedies for seasickness of this virulent sort, not being accustomed to long voyages," Lawrence said. "Would you not make up some physic for him?"
"Well, he is not my patient, and I would not like to be accused of interference. I do not suppose their medical men take any kinder view of it than do we,"
Pollitt said apologetically.
"But in any case, I think I should rather prescribe a course of ship's biscuit. There is very little offence any stomach can take at biscuit, I find, and who knows what sort of foreign cookery he has been teasing himself with.
A little biscuit and perhaps a light wine will set him up properly again, I'm sure."
Of course, the foreign cookery was native to Liu Bao, but Lawrence saw nothing to argue with in this course of action, and later that evening sent over a large packet of biscuit, picked over by a reluctant Roland and Dyer to remove the weevils, and the real sacrifice, three bottles of a particularly sprightly Riesling, very light, indeed almost airy, and purchased at a cost of 6 shillings and 3 pence apiece from a Portsmouth wine merchant. Lawrence felt a little odd in making the gesture. He hoped he would have done as much in any case, but there was more calculation in it than he had ever been used to make, and there was just a shade of dishonesty, a shade of flattery to it which he could not entirely like or approve of in himself. And indeed he felt some general qualms about any overture at all, given the insult of the confiscation of the East India Company's ships, which he had no more forgotten than any of the sailors who still watched the Chinese with sullen dislike. But he excused himself to Temeraire privately that night, having seen his offering delivered into Liu Bao's cabin. "After all, it is not their fault personally, any more than it would be mine if the king were to do the same to them. If government makes not a sound over the matter, they can hardly be blamed for treating it so lightly. They, at least, have not made the slightest attempt at concealing the incident, nor been dishonest in the least." Even as he said it, he was still not quite satisfied. But there was no other choice. He did not mean to be sitting about, doing nothing, nor could he rely upon Hammond. Skill and wit the diplomat might possess, but Lawrence was by now convinced that there was no intention on his part of expending much effort to keep Temeraire. To Hammond, the dragon was only a bargaining chip. There was certainly no hope of persuading Yong Xing, but so far as the other members of the embassy might be won over, in good faith he meant to try, and if the effort should tax him in his pride, that was small sacrifice. It proved worthwhile. Liu Bao crept from his cabin again the next day, looking less wretched, and by the subsequent morning was well enough to send for the translator, and ask Lawrence to come over to their side of the deck and join him. Some colour back in his face, and much relief. He had also brought along one of the cooks. The biscuits, he reported, had worked wonders, taken on his own physician's recommendation with a little fresh ginger, and he was urgent to know how they might be made.
"Well, they are mostly flour and a bit of water, but I cannot tell you anything more, I am afraid," Lawrence said. "We do not bake them aboard, you see, but I assure you we have enough in the bread-room to last you twice around the world, sir."
"Once has been more than enough for me," Liu Bao said. "An old man like me has no business going so far away from home, and being tossed around on the waves. Since we came on this ship, I have not been able to eat anything, not even a few pancakes, until those biscuits. But this morning I was able to have some congee and fish, and I was not sick at all. I am very grateful to you."
"I am happy to have been of service, sir. Indeed you look much improved," Lawrence said.
"That is very polite, even if it is not very truthful," Liu Bao said.
He held out his arm ruefully and shook it, the robe hanging rather loose.
"I will take some fattening up to look like myself again."
"If you feel equal to it, sir, may I invite you to join us for dinner tomorrow evening?"
Lawrence asked, thinking this overture, though barely, enough encouragement to justify the invitation.
"It is our holiday, and I am giving a dinner for my officers. You would be very welcome, and any of your compatriots who might wish to join you."
This dinner proved far more successful than the last. Granby was still laid up in the sick berth, forbidden rich food, but Lieutenant Ferris was bent on making the most of his opportunity to impress, and in any direction which offered. He was a young officer and energetic, very lately promoted to Temeraire's captain of topmen, on account of a fine boarding engagement he had led at Trafalgar. In ordinary course it would have been at least another year, and more likely two or three, before he could hope to become a second lieutenant in his own right, but with poor Evans sent home, he had stepped into his place as acting second, and plainly hoped to keep the position. In the morning, Lawrence, with some amusement, overheard him sternly lecturing the midwing men on the need to behave in a civilized manner at table and not sit around like lumps. Lawrence suspected that he even primed the junior officers with a handful of anecdotes, as occasionally during the meal he glared significantly at one or the other of the boys, and the target would hastily gulp his wine and start in on a story rather improbable for an officer of such tender years. Sun Kai accompanied Liu Bao, but as before had the air of an observer rather than a guest. But Liu Bao displayed no similar restraint, and had plainly come ready to be pleased, though indeed it would have been a hard man who could have resisted the suckling pig, spit-roasted since that morning, and glowing under its glaze of butter and cream. They neither of them disdained a second helping, and Liu Bao was also loud in his approval of the crackling brown goose, a handsome specimen acquired specially for the occasion at Madeira, and still smug and fat at the time of its demise, unlike the usual poultry to be had at sea. The civil exertions of the officers had an effect also, as stumbling and awkward as some of the younger fellows were about it. Liu Bao had a generous laugh easily provoked, and he shared many amusing stories of his own, mostly about hunting misadventures. Only the poor translator was unhappy, as he had a great deal of work scurrying back and forth around the table, alternately putting English into Chinese and then the reverse. Almost from the beginning the atmosphere was wholly different and wholly amiable. Sun Kai remained quiet, listening more than speaking, and Lawrence could not be sure he was enjoying himself. He ate still in an abstemious fashion and drank very little, though Liu Bao, himself not at all lacking in capacity, would good-naturedly scold him from time to time and fill his glass again to the brim. But after the great Christmas pudding was ceremoniously borne out, flickering blue with branded flames to shared applause, to be dismantled, served, and enjoyed, Liu Bao turned and said to him,
"You are being very dull tonight. Here, sing The Hard Road for us. That is the proper poem for this journey."
For all his reserve, Sun Kai seemed quite willing to oblige. He cleared his throat and recited, "Pure wine costs for the golden bowl 10,000 coppers a flagon, and a jade platter of dainty food calls for 1,000,000 coins. I fling aside my bowl and meat, I cannot eat or drink. I raise my talons to the sky, I peer 4 ways in vain. I would cross the yellow river, but ice takes hold of my limbs. I would fly above the Taihang mountains, but the sky is blind with snow. I would sit and watch the golden carp, lazy by a brook, but I suddenly dream of crossing the waves, sailing for the sun. Journeying is hard, journeying is hard. There are many turnings. Which am I to follow? I will mount a long wind some day and break the heavy bank of clouds, and set my wings straight to bridge the wide, wide sea." If there was any rhyme or metre to the piece, it vanished in the translation, but the content the aviators uniformly approved and applauded.
"Is it your own work, sir?"
Lawrence asked with interest. "I do not believe I have ever heard a poem from the view of a dragon."
"No, no," Sun Kai said. "It is one of the works of the honoured Lung Le Po of the Tang dynasty. I am only a poor scholar, and my verses are not worthy of being shared in company."
He was perfectly happy, however, to give them several other selections from classical poets, all recited from memory in what seemed to Lawrence a prodigious feat of recall. All the guests rolled away at last on the most harmonious of terms, having carefully avoided any discussion of British and Chinese sovereignty regarding either ships or dragons.
"I will be so bold as to say it was a success," Lawrence said afterwards, sipping coffee upon the dragon deck while Temeraire ate his sheep. "They are not so very stiff-necked in company after all, and I can call myself really satisfied with Liu Bao. I have been in many a ship where I should have been grateful to dine with his good company.
Well, I am glad you had a pleasant evening, Temeraire said, grinding thoughtfully upon the leg bones. Can you say that poem over again?
Lawrence had to canvass his officers to attempt to reconstruct the poem. They were still at it the next morning, when Yong Xing came up to take the air, and listened to them mangling the translation. After they had made a few attempts, he frowned, and then turned to Temeraire, and himself recited the poem. Yong Xing spoke in Chinese, without translation, but nevertheless, after a single hearing, Temeraire was able to repeat the verses back to him in the same language, with not the least evidence of difficulty. It was not the first time that Lawrence had been surprised by Temeraire's skill with language. Like all dragons, Temeraire had learned speech during the long maturity in the shell, but unlike most, he had been exposed to 3 different tongues, and evidently remembered even what must have been his earliest.
"Lawrence," Temeraire said,
turning his head towards him with excitement, after exchanging a few more words in Chinese with Yong Xing.
"He says that it was written by a dragon, not a man at all."
Lawrence, still taken aback to find that Temeraire could speak the language, blinked yet again at this intelligence.
"Poetry seems an odd sort of occupation for a dragon. But I suppose if other Chinese dragons like books as well as you do, it is not so surprising one of them should have tried his hand at verse."
"I wonder how he wrote it," Temeraire said thoughtfully. "I might like to try, but I do not see how I would ever put it down. I do not think I could hold a pen."
He raised his own foreleg and examined the 5-fingered claw dubiously.
"I would be happy to take your dictation," Lawrence said, amused by the notion. "I expect that is how he managed."
He thought nothing more of it until 2 days later, when he came back on deck, grim and worried after sitting a long while again in the sick berth. The stubborn fever had recurred, and Granby lay pale and half-present, his blue eyes wide and fixed sightlessly upon the distant recesses of the ceiling, his lips parted and cracked. He took only a little water, and when he spoke his words were confused and wandering. Pollitt would give no opinion, and only shook his head a little. Ferris was standing anxiously at the bottom of the dragon deck stairs, waiting for him, and at his expression Lawrence quickened his still limping pace.
"Sir," Ferris said, "I do not know what to do. He has been talking to Temeraire all morning, and we cannot tell what he is saying."
Lawrence hastened up the steps and found Yong Xing seated in an armchair on the deck and conversing with Temeraire in Chinese, the prince speaking rather slowly and loudly, enunciating his words and correcting Temeraire's own speech in return. He had also brought up several sheets of paper and had painted a handful of their odd-looking characters upon them in large size. Temeraire indeed looked fascinated. His attention was wholly engaged, and the tip of his tail was flicking back and forth in mid-air as when he was particularly excited.
"Lawrence, look, that is dragon in their writing," Temeraire said,
catching sight of him and calling him forward. Lawrence obediently stared at the picture, rather blankly. To him it looked like nothing more than the patterns sometimes left marked on a sandy shore after a tide. Even when Temeraire had pointed out the portion of the symbol which represented the dragon's wings, and then the body.
"Do they only have a single letter for the entire word?" Lawrence said dubiously. "How is it pronounced?"
"It is said Lung," Temeraire said, "like in my Chinese name, Lung Tian Xiang. And Tian is for celestials," he added proudly, pointing to another symbol.
Yong Xing was watching them both, with no very marked outward expression, but Lawrence thought perhaps a suggestion of triumph in his eyes.
"I am very glad you have been so pleasantly occupied," Lawrence said to Temeraire,
and turning to Yong Xing made a deliberate bow, addressing him without invitation.
"You are very kind, sir, to take such pains."
Yong Xing answered him stiffly.
"I consider it a duty. The study of the classics is the path to understanding."
His manner was hardly welcoming, but if he chose to ignore the boundary and speak with Temeraire, Lawrence considered it the equivalent of a formal call, and himself justified in initiating conversation. Whether or not Yong Xing privately agreed, Lawrence's forwardness did not deter him from future visits. Every morning now began to find him upon the deck, giving Temeraire daily lessons in the language and offering him further samples of Chinese literature to whet his appetite. Lawrence at first suffered only irritation at these transparent attempts at enticement. Temeraire looked much brighter than he had since parting from Maximus and Lily, and though he might dislike the source, Lawrence could not begrudge Temeraire the opportunity for so much new mental occupation when he was as yet confined to the deck by his wound. As for the notion that Temeraire's loyalty would be swayed by any number of Oriental blandishments, Yongxing might entertain such a belief if he liked. Lawrence had no doubts. But he could not help but feel a rather sinking sensation as the days went on, and Temeraire did not tire of the subject. Their own books were now often neglected in favour of recitation of one or another piece of Chinese literature, which Temeraire liked to get by rote, as he could not write them down or read them. Lawrence was well aware he was nothing like a scholar. His own notion of pleasant occupation was to spend an afternoon in conversation, perhaps writing letters or reading a newspaper when one not excessively out of date could be had. Although under Temeraire's influence he had gradually come to enjoy books far more than he had ever imagined he could, it was a good deal harder to share Temeraire's excitement over works in a language he could not make head or tail of himself. He did not mean to give Yongxing the satisfaction of seeing him at all discomfited, but it did feel like a victory for the prince at his own expense, particularly on those occasions when Temeraire mastered a new piece, and visibly glowed under Yongxing's rare and hard-won praise. Lawrence worried also that Yongxing seemed almost surprised by Temeraire's progress, and often especially pleased. Lawrence naturally thought Temeraire remarkable among dragons, but this was not an opinion he desired Yongxing to share. The prince scarcely needed any additional motive to try and take Temeraire away. As some consolation, Temeraire was constantly shifting into English, that he might draw Lawrence in, and Yongxing had perforce to make polite conversation with him, or risk losing what advantage he had gained. But while this might be satisfying in a petty sort of way, Lawrence could not be said to enjoy these conversations much. Any natural kinship of spirit must have been inadequate in the face of so violent a practical opposition, and they would scarcely have been inclined towards one another in any case. One morning Yongxing came on deck early, with Temeraire still sleeping, and while his attendants brought out his chair and draped it, and arranged for him the scrolls which he meant to read to Temeraire that day, the prince came to the edge of the deck to gaze out at the ocean. They were in the midst of a lovely stretch of blue water sailing, no shore in sight, and the wind coming fresh and cool off the sea, and Lawrence was himself standing in the bows to enjoy the vista, dark water stretching endlessly to the horizon, occasional little waves overlapping one another in a white froth, and the ship all alone beneath the curving bowl of the sky.
"Only in the desert can one find so desolate and uninteresting a view,"
Yongxing said abruptly. As Lawrence had been on the point of offering a polite remark about the beauty of the scene, he was left dumb and baffled, and still more so when Yongxing added,
"You British are forever sailing off to some new place. Are you so discontented with your own country?"
He did not wait for an answer, but shook his head and turned away, leaving Lawrence again confirmed in his belief that he could hardly have found a man less in sympathy with himself on any point. Temeraire's shipboard diet would ordinarily have been mostly fish, caught by himself. Lawrence and Granby had planned on it in their calculations of supply, cattle and sheep intended for variety's sake, and in case of bad weather which might keep Temeraire confined to the ship. But barred from flying because of his wound, Temeraire could not hunt, and so he was consuming their stores at a far more rapid pace than they had originally counted upon. "We will have to keep close to the Saharan coastline in any case, or risk being blown straight across to Rio by the trade winds," Riley said. "We can certainly stop at Cape Coast to take on supplies." This was meant to console him. Lawrence only nodded and went away. Riley's father had plantations in the West Indies, and several hundred slaves to work them, while Lawrence's own father was a firm supporter of Wilberforce and Clarkson, and had made several very cutting speeches in the Lords against the trade, on one occasion even mentioning Riley's father by name in a list of slave-holding gentlemen who, as he had mildly put it,
"disgrace the name of Christian and blight the character and reputation of their country."
The incident had made a coolness between them at the time. Riley was deeply attached to his father, a man of far greater personal warmth than Lord Allendale, and naturally resented the public insult. Lawrence, while lacking a particularly strong degree of affection for his own father, and angry to be put in so unhappy a position, was yet not at all willing to offer any sort of apology. He had grown up with the pamphlets and books put out by Clarkson's committee all about the house, and at the age of 9 had been taken on a tour of a former slave ship, about to be broken up. The nightmares had lingered afterwards for several months, and made upon his young mind a profound impression. They had never made peace on the subject, but only settled into a truce. They neither of them mentioned the subject again, and studiously avoided discussing either parent. Lawrence could not now speak frankly to Riley about how very reluctant he was to put in at a slave port, though he was not at all easy in his mind at the prospect. Instead, he privately asked Keynes whether Temeraire was not healing well, and might be permitted short flights again for hunting.
"Best not," the surgeon said reluctantly.
Lawrence looked at him sharply, and at last drew from Keynes the admission that he had some concern. The wound was not healing as he would like.
"The muscles are still warm to the touch, and I believe I feel some drawn flesh beneath the hide," Keynes said. "It is far too soon to have any real concern. However, I do not intend to take any risks. No flying, for at least another 2 weeks."
So by this conversation Lawrence merely gained one additional source of private care. There were sufficient others already, besides the shortage of food and the now unavoidable stop at Cape Coast. With Temeraire's injury, as well as Yong Xing's steadfast opposition precluding any work aloft, the aviators had been left almost entirely idle, while at the same time the sailors had been particularly busy with repairing the damage to the ship and making her stores, and a host of not unpredictable evils had followed. Thinking to offer Roland and Dyer some distraction, Lawrence had called the two of them up to the Dragon Deck shortly before the arrival in Madeira, to examine them in their schoolwork. They had stared at him with such guilty expressions that he was not surprised to find they had neglected their studies entirely since having become his runners. Very little notion of arithmetic, none at all of the more advanced mathematics, no French whatsoever. And when he handed them Gibbon's book, which he had brought to the deck meaning to read to Temeraire later, Roland stuttered so over the words that Temeraire put back his ruff and began to correct her from memory. Dyer was a little better off. When quizzed, he at least had his multiplication tables mostly by heart, and some sense of grammar. Roland stumbled over anything higher than 8, and professed herself surprised to learn that speech even had parts. Lawrence no longer wondered how he would fill their time. He only reproached himself for having been so lax about their schooling, and set about his newly self-appointed task as their schoolmaster with a will. The runners had always been rather pets of the entire crew. Since Morgan's death, Roland and Dyer had been cosseted still more. Their daily struggles with participles and division were now looked on by the other aviators with great amusement, but only until the allegiance's midshipmen made some jeering noises. Then the ensigns took it on themselves to repay the insult, and a few scuffles ensued in dark corners of the ship. At first, Lawrence and Riley entertained themselves by a comparison of the wooden excuses which were offered them for the collection of black eyes and bleeding lips. But the petty squabbling began to take a more ominous shape when older men started to present similar excuses. A deeper resentment on the sailors' part, founded in no small part in the uneven balance of labour and their fear of Temeraire, was finding expression in the near daily exchange of insults, no longer even touching upon Roland and Dyer's studies. In their turn, the aviators had taken a reciprocal offence at the complete lack of gratitude that seemed to them due to Temeraire's valour. The first true explosion occurred just as they began to make the turn eastward, past Cape Palmas, and headed towards Cape Coast. Lawrence was drowsing on the Dragon Deck, sheltered by the shadow of Temeraire's body from the direct force of the sun. He did not see himself what had happened, but he was roused by a heavy thump, sudden shouts and cries, and climbing hurriedly to his feet saw the men in a ring. Martin was gripping Blythe, the armourer's mate, by the arm. One of Riley's officers, an older midshipman, was stretched out on the deck, and Lord Purbeck was shouting from the poop deck, "Set that man in irons, Cornell! Straight away!" Temeraire's head came straight up, and he roared, not raising the divine wind, thankfully, but he made a great and thundering noise nonetheless, and the men all scattered back from it, many with pale faces.
"'No one is putting any of my crew in prison,'
Temeraire said angrily, his tail lashing the air. He raised himself and spread wide his wings, and the whole ship shivered. The wind was blowing out from the Saharan coast, abaft the beam, the sails close hauled to keep them on their southeast course, and Temeraire's wings were acting as an independent and contrary sail.
"'Temeraire, stop that at once! At once, do you hear me?' Lawrence said sharply.
He had never spoken so, not since the first weeks of Temeraire's existence, and Temeraire dropped down in surprise, his wings furling in tight on instinct.
"'Purbeck, you will leave my men to me, if you please. Stand down, master-at-arms,' Lawrence said, snapping orders quickly.
He did not mean to allow the scene to progress further, nor turn into some open struggle between the aviators and seamen.
"'Mr. Ferris,' he said, "'take Blythe below and confine him.' "'Yes, sir,' Ferris said,
already shoving through the crowd and pushing the aviators back around him, breaking up the knots of angry men even before he reached Blythe. Watching the progress with hard eyes, Lawrence added loudly,
"'Mr. Martin, to my cabin at once. Back to your work, all of you. Mr. Keynes, come here.'
He stayed another moment, but he was satisfied. The pressing danger had been averted. He turned from the rail, trusting to ordinary discipline to break up the rest of the crowd. But Temeraire was huddled down very nearly flat, looking at him with a startled, unhappy expression. Lawrence reached out to him and flinched as Temeraire twitched away. Not out of reach, but the impulse plainly visible.
"'Forgive me,' Lawrence said, dropping his hand, a tightness in his throat. "'Temeraire,' he said, and stopped.
He did not know what to say, for Temeraire could not be allowed to act so. He might have caused real damage to the ship, and aside from that, if he carried on in such a fashion, the crew would shortly grow too terrified of him to do their work.
"'You have not hurt yourself?'
he asked instead, as Keynes hurried over.
"'No,' Temeraire said very quietly. "'I am perfectly well.'
He submitted to being examined in silence, and Keynes pronounced him unharmed by the exertion.
"'I must go and speak with Martin,' Lawrence said, still at a loss.
Temeraire did not answer, but curled himself up and swept his wings forward around his head, and after a long moment Lawrence left the deck and went below. The cabin was close and hot, even with all the windows standing open, and not calculated to improve Lawrence's temper. Martin was pacing the length of the cabin in agitation. He was untidy in a suit of warm-weather slops, his face 2 days unshaven and presently flushed, his hair too long and flopping over his eyes. He did not recognize the degree of Lawrence's real anger, but burst out talking the moment Lawrence came in.
"'I am so very sorry. It was all my fault. I oughtn't have spoken at all,' he said,
even while Lawrence limped to his chair and sat down heavily.
"'You cannot punish Blythe, Lawrence.'
Lawrence had grown used to the lack of formality among aviators, and ordinarily did not balk at this liberty in passing, but for Martin to make use of it under the circumstances was so egregious that Lawrence sat back and stared at him, outrage plainly written on his face. Martin went pale under his freckled skin, swallowed, and hurriedly said,
"'I mean, Captain, sir?'
"'I will do whatever I must to keep order among this crew, Mr. Martin, which appears to be more than I thought necessary,' Lawrence said, and moderated his volume only with a great effort. He felt truly savage. "'You will tell me at once what happened.'
"'I didn't mean to,' Martin said, much subdued. "'That fellow Reynolds has been making remarks all week, and Ferris told us to pay him no mind, but I was walking by, and he said,
"'I'm not interested in hearing you bear tales,' Lawrence said. "'What did you do?'
"'Oh,' Martin said, flushing, "'I only said—' "'Well, I said something back, which I should rather not repeat, and then he—'
Martin stopped and looked somewhat confused as to how to finish the story without seeming to accuse Reynolds again, and finished lamely.
"'At any rate, sir, he was on the point of offering me a challenge, and that was when Blythe knocked him down. He only did it because he knew I could not fight, and did not want to see me have to refuse in front of the sailors. Truly, sir, it is my fault and not his.'
"'I cannot disagree with you in the least,' Lawrence said brutally,
and was glad in his anger to see Martin's shoulders hunch forward as if struck.
"'And when I have to have Blythe flogged on Sunday for striking an officer, I hope you will keep in mind that he is paying for your lack of self-restraint. You are dismissed. You are to keep below decks and to your quarters for the week, save when defaulters are called.'
Martin's lips worked a moment. His "yes, sir," emerged only faintly, and he was almost stumbling as he left the room. Lawrence sat still breathing harshly, almost panting in the thick air. The anger slowly deserted him in spite of every effort, and gave way to a heavier, bitter oppression. Blythe had saved not only Martin's reputation, but that of the aviators as a whole. If Martin had openly refused a challenge made in front of the entire crew, it would have blackened all their characters, no matter that it was forced on them by the regulations of the Corps, which forbade duelling. And yet there was no room for leniency in the matter whatsoever. Blythe had openly struck an officer before witnesses, and Lawrence would have to sentence him to sufficient punishment to give the sailors satisfaction and all of the men pause against any future capers of the sort, and the punishment would be carried out by the boatswain's mate, a sailor, like as not to relish the chance to be severe on an aviator, particularly for such an offence. He would have to go and speak with Blythe, but a tapping at the door broke in upon him before he could rise, and Riley came in, unsmiling, in his coat and with his hat under his arm, neckcloth freshly tied.
Chapter 7 They drew near Cape Coast a week later, with the atmosphere of ill will a settled and living thing among them, as palpable as the heat. Blythe had taken ill from his brutal flogging. He still lay nearly senseless in the sickbay, the other ground crew hands taking it in turn to sit by him and fan the bloody wheels, and to coax him to take some water. They had taken the measure of Lawrence's temper, and so their bitterness against the sailors was not expressed in word or direct action, but in sullen, black looks and murmurs, and abrupt silences whenever a sailor came in earshot. Lawrence had not dined in the great cabin since the incident. Riley had been offended at having Purbeck corrected on the deck. Lawrence had grown short in turn when Riley refused to unbend, and made it plain he was not satisfied by the dozen lashes which were all Lawrence would sentence. In the heat of discussion, Lawrence had let slip some suggestion of his distaste for going to the slave port. Riley had resented the implication, and they had ended not in shouting, but in cold formality. But worse by far than this, Temeraire's spirits were very low. He had forgiven Lawrence the moment of harshness, and been persuaded to understand that some punishment was necessary for the offence, but he had not been at all reconciled to the actual event, and during the flogging he had growled savagely when Blythe had screamed towards the end. Some good had come of that. The boatswain's mate Hingley, who had been wielding the cat with more than usual energy, had been alarmed, and the last couple of strokes had been mild. But the damage had already been done. Temeraire had since remained unhappy and quiet, answering only briefly, and he was not eating well. The sailors, for their part, were as dissatisfied with a light sentence as the aviators were with the brutality. Poor Martin, set to tanning hides with a harness master for punishment, was more wretched with guilt than from his punishment, and spent every spare moment at Blythe's bedside. And the only person at all satisfied with the situation was Yong Shing, who seized the opportunity to hold several more long conversations with Temeraire in Chinese, privately, as Temeraire made no effort to include Lawrence. Yong Shing looked less pleased, however, at the conclusion of the last of these, when Temeraire hissed, put back his ruff, and then proceeded to all but knock Lawrence off his feet in coiling possessively around him.
"What has he been saying to you?" Lawrence demanded, trying futilely to peer above the great black sides rising around him. He had already reached a state of high irritation at Yong Shing's continued interference, and was very nearly at the end of his patience.
"He has been telling me about China, and how things are managed there for dragons," Temeraire said evasively, by which Lawrence suspected that Temeraire had liked these described arrangements. "But then he told me I should have a more worthy companion there, and you would be sent away."
By the time he could be persuaded to uncoil himself again, Yong Shing had gone.
"Looking mad as fire," Ferris reported, with glee unbecoming a senior lieutenant.
This scarcely contented Lawrence.
"I am not going to have Temeraire distressed in this manner," he said to Hammond angrily, trying without success to persuade the diplomat to carry a highly undiplomatic message to the prince.
"You are taking a very short-sighted view of the matter," Hammond said maddeningly. If Prince Yongxing can be convinced over the course of this journey that Temeraire will not agree to be parted from you, all the better for us. They will be far more ready to negotiate when finally we arrive in China." He paused and asked, with still more infuriating anxiousness, "You are quite certain that he will not agree?" On hearing the account that evening, Granby said,
"I say we heave Hammond and Yongxing over the side together some dark night, and good riddance,"
expressing Lawrence's private sentiments more frankly than Lawrence himself felt he could. Granby was speaking, with no regard for manners, between bites of a light meal of soup, toasted cheese, potatoes fried in pork fat with onions, an entire roast chicken, and a mince pie. He had finally been released from his sick bed, pallid and much reduced in weight, and Lawrence had invited him to supper.
"What else was that prince saying to him?"
"I have not the least idea. He has not said three words together in English the last week," Lawrence said. "And I do not mean to press Temeraire to tell me. It would be the most officious, prying sort of behaviour."
"That none of his friends should ever be flogged there, I expect," Granby said darkly, "and that he should have a dozen books to read every day and heaps of jewels. I have heard stories about this sort of thing. But if a fellow ever really tried it, they would drum him out of the core quick as lightning, if the dragon did not carve him into joints first."
Lawrence was silent a moment, twisting his wine-glass in his fingers.
"Temeraire is only listening to it at all because he is unhappy."
"Oh, hell!" Granby sat back heavily. "I am damned sorry I have been sick so long. Ferris is a right'un, but he hasn't been on a transport before. He couldn't know how the sailors get and how to properly teach the fellows to take no notice,"
he said glumly.
"And I can't give you any advice for cheering him up. I served with Litificat longest, and she is easy-going even for a regal copper. No temper to speak of, and no mood I ever saw could dampen her appetite. Maybe it is not being allowed to fly."
They came into the harbour the next morning. A broad semicircle with a golden beach dotted with attractive palms under the squat white walls of the overlooking castle. A multitude of rough canoes, many with branches still attached to the trunks from which they had been hollowed, were plying the waters of the harbour, and besides these they could be seen an assortment of brigs and schooners, and at the western end a snow of middling size, with her boats swarming back and forth, crowded with blacks who were being herded along from a tunnel mouth that came out onto the beach itself. The Allegiance was too large to come into the harbour proper, but she had anchored close enough. The day was calm, and the cracking of the whips, perfectly audible over the water, mingled with cries and the steady sound of weeping. Lawrence came frowning onto the deck and ordered Roland and Dyer away from their wide-eyed staring, sending them below to tidy his cabin. Temeraire could not be protected in the same manner, and was observing the proceedings with some confusion, the slitted pupils of his eyes widening and narrowing as he stared.
"Lawrence, those men are all in chains. What can so many of them have done?"
he demanded, roused from his apathy.
"They cannot all have committed crimes. Look, that one over there is a small child. And there is another."
"No," Lawrence said, "that is a slaver. Pray do not watch."
Fearing this moment, he had made a vague attempt at explaining the idea of slavery to Temeraire, with his lack of success due as much to his own distaste as to Temeraire's difficulty with the notion of property. Temeraire did not listen now, but kept watching, his tail switching rapidly in anxiety. The loading of the vessel continued throughout the morning, and the hot wind blowing from the shore carried the sour smell of unwashed bodies, sweating and ill with misery. At length the boarding was finished, and the Snow, with her unhappy cargo, came out of the harbour and spread her sails to the wind, throwing up a fine furrow as she went past them, already moving at a steady pace, sailors scrambling in the rigging. But full half her crew were only armed landsmen, sitting idly about on deck with their muskets and pistols and mugs of grog. They stared openly at Temeraire, curious, their faces unsmiling, sweating and grimy from the work. One of them even picked up his gun and sighted along it at Temeraire, as if for sport.
"Present arms!" Lieutenant Riggs snapped, before Lawrence could even react, and the three riflemen on deck had their guns ready in an instant. Across the water, the fellow lowered his musket and grinned, showing strong, yellowed teeth, and turned back to his shipmates, laughing. Temeraire's ruff was flattened.
not out of any fear, as a musket ball fired at such a range would have done him less injury than a mosquito to a man, but with great distaste. He gave a low, rumbling growl, and almost drew a deep, preparatory breath. Lawrence laid a hand on his side, quietly said,
"No, it can do no good,"
and stayed with him until at last the snow shrank away over the horizon and passed out of their sight. Even after she had gone, Temeraire's tail continued to flick unhappily back and forth.
"No, I am not hungry," he said, when Lawrence suggested some food,
and stayed very quiet again, occasionally scraping at the deck with his claws, unconsciously making a dreadful grating noise.